has been to basically, well, I hate the word basic. Has been to introduce you to the essential fundamentals of low energy supersymmetry. And we haven't been talking a lot about specific models of supersymmetry breaking and so on, but there's actually a good reason for that, which I'll come to towards the end of the lecture. But I can tell you now. There isn't anything that really particularly sticks out as being preferred over anything else after all the time we've put into thinking about these things. And furthermore, the essential issues that were driving people's thinking about low energy supersymmetry for the past 20, 25 years changed, I think, not that dramatically, but there's been a gradual evolution in what people cared about. And so the real essential problem and or set of challenges to this idea, I think, have really only emerged in the past 5 years or so, where people have really started finally focusing on the correct set of issues. So you're not particularly behind not knowing anything about all the models that people have built for 20, 25 years. And at the end of the lecture, I'll tell you everything you need to know for the LHC era about supersymmetry, and then you can really forget about all the models that people have built. So, you know, those of us who spent a long time thinking about these things will just have the displeasure of having 99.9% of those ideas ruled out by month 3 of the LHC, and, you know, you won't have that disadvantage. But I will tell you everything you really need to know. But let's finish up finally. But it is important, you know, it is important to at least have all the essentials down once. So let's finish that up before I start talking about the real physics. So we finished talking about the structure of supersymmetric theories, supersymmetry breaking, and the fact that any supersymmetry breaking theory at low energies will look like it turns on soft terms, and that we can think of those soft terms conveniently as turning on higher components of all the coupling constants in the theory viewed as superfields. Okay, so that's a very nice conceptual way of thinking about them. Of course, we'll talk about the MSSM in half an hour, but in that case, we want the soft terms to be around the TED scale, and in order to solve the hierarchy problem. And we also mentioned that another generic consequence of supersymmetry breaking is the presence of the Golcino, which is eaten up into the longitudinal component of the gravitino, and there's two distinct regimes of interest for the phenomenology, where the gravitino is heavier than the TEB scale, where we largely don't care about it as far as particle physics is concerned, and when it's much lighter than the TEB scale, where we do care about it, and in fact the Golcino is the end product of every superpartner decay eventually. And we talked about what the universal low energy theory is for the interaction of Golcinos with everything else that's controlled by symmetries. All right, so what I want to do today is finish talking about SUSY by talking about its radiative properties. This is, after all, this was the point that we thought theories with a symmetry between bosons and fermions would allow us to control the ultraviolet sensitivity of the scalar masses, inheriting chiral symmetries from the fermion masses. And so let's really see that in detailed action now. So let's start again with the simplest theory of a chiral superfield with a 5-cubed coupling. Okay. Now, so you know, among other things, this theory is a 5-4 interaction. Okay. And there's all sorts of things that you worry when you have a 5-4 interaction. There's, of course, the quadratic divergences that we talked about. There's also just usual running, right? So, you know, you would think normally I have corrections that look like that. This theory also has a Yukawa coupling, right, as we've discussed. So that also affects things like this. And we have wave function renormalization, the same diagrams as the hierarchy problem diagrams. So there's the quadratic divergences here, but there's also logarithmic divergences in this diagram and not in that diagram. There's no log divergence in this diagram, of course, but there's a log divergence here. So this is the usual sort of thing you expect in a quantum field theory. We have wave function normalizations, vertex normalizations, and so on. But the situation is actually drastically simpler, much, much simpler in a supersymmetric theory. Okay, and in order to see that, let's be a little naive. It's always a good idea in general to do the dumbest thing first. Okay, so this is the first rule of progress in theoretical physics. Do the dumbest thing first. If the dumbest thing works, declare victory. If the dumbest thing doesn't work, figure out what's wrong with the dumbest thing, and that'll tell you the next dumbest thing. And soon you're doing something smart out of many, many dumb steps. Okay? So, and I'm not joking. So at least that's how some of us get by. Okay. So let's go here and say, look, what happens in a normal theory? In a normal theory, there's a correction to lambda that goes like some constant lambda squared and a logarithmic divergence. Right? That's what normally happens. Let me put the 16 pi squared here. All right, so that's probably what's happening in this theory too, right? So here we go. There's d4 theta phi dagger phi, and there's lambda phi cubed plus lambda squared over 16 pi squared log lambda, some cutoff, some coefficient phi cubed. Okay? But that's impossible. This is impossible. This coefficient, this cannot be there. Why can it not be there? It can't be there because of holomorphy. Because of the fact that everything in the superpotential has got to be a function of not only phi, but here's where it really pays to think about the coupling constants as themselves background chiral superfields. You see, it's also got to be a function of lambda and not lambda dagger. Okay? Because lambda could be a chiral superfield, and then if it was, then I can't have a lambda-lambda. I can't have a lambda-dagger-lambda in the superpotential. Okay, so I definitely can't have that. Okay, well, holomorphy allows me to have a lambda-squared, but something else doesn't allow me to have a lambda-squared, which is that this theory has a U1 symmetry under which phi has charge 1 and lambda has charge minus 3. So then there can only be something that goes like lambda. The thing that goes like lambda squared would now have the wrong charge. So that's impossible. Is this clear? No, this is just a constant. It's not, it's just because I'm writing it down because I forget what it is. It's some number. You can't promote the number 3 to a spurious field. Okay? You have the theory, here's the theory, and then you compute with the theory. And so you see, it's the holomorphy of the superpotential that makes it impossible to have this. Now, on the other hand, there's nothing stops you from having something like some constant lambda dagger lambda over 16 pi squared log. Okay? That's perfectly allowed. Lambda dagger lambda has vanishing charge. So that's why I can have a correction in the Cayley potential, but I cannot have a correction in the superpotential. And this simple fact about chiral superfields, this generalizes to any theory. Okay? To any order of perturbation theory, there's never any correction to the superpotential, because the superpotential is a special holomorphic object. You can have corrections in the Cayley potential. So said another way, in supersymmetric theories, all of the renormalization, all the logarithmic divergences, in fact, all the radiative corrections, period, are Cayley corrections. Wave function normalization as the logarithmic divergences, and other corrections in the d4 theta part, nothing in the d squared theta part. Okay, so this is very important, so if it's not clear, tell me and I'll say it again.
Well, that's okay. You don't have to see.
You always do. So this is here's another exercise. Okay. So prove what I just said for a completely general chiral theory. Okay. You can show that it's always possible to assign U1 charges to the coupling constants to be able to make this argument. So start by doing it with a theory of two chiral superfields, and then you'll see how it works. Okay. All right, yes?
If lambda is a chiral field,
yes.
What is the Feynman rule?
Sorry?
What is the Feynman rule?
This is what's also particularly nice, is you can just make lambda a number, compute away, and then everywhere you see a lambda, you can then promote it and say, that's got to be a chiral superfield. So you don't actually have to change any Feynman rules anywhere. You don't have to do anything. Okay. And it's, again, because you know ahead of time, regardless of how you do the computation, you know ahead of time that it's got to look like this. That if there's anything in the superpotential, it's got to have lambdas in it and lambda squared and no lambda daggers. Okay, and in the Taylor potential, it's got to have lambdas and lambda daggers. So you know ahead of time it must look like that, no matter how you compute it. Because you know it looks like that, then you also know what it must be when lambda is a full superfield. You just take the answer you had beforehand and you make lambda a full superfield. This is going to be a key in a second for a number of exact results I'm going to tell you. Okay, but also another thing, I took you on a sort of a geodesic path through superspace. If you open Wetzenbagger's book, there's 9 chapters on superspace. You know, you don't need to know any of it other than what I told you. None of it is important for anything. None of it is really important for anything other than what I'm telling you. Okay. It's important to remember the component Lagrangian. It's important to know what the component Lagrangian looks like. It's important to know the superspace structure in order to be able to make the arguments that I'm just making. But all the stuff about d's, d bars, d by d y's, especially superspace Feynman rules, please do not waste any of your life learning superspace Feynman rules. I did. Okay, I spent 1 month. Miserable month as a graduate student learning superspace Feynman rules, and it's a complete waste of time. It's a total, unless you're these super experts who make their living at it. If you're anyone else, it's a waste of time. You don't need to know anything more. I'm telling you the truth. You don't need to know anything more about superspace than what I've told you. But this much is very powerful. And as we'll see, it's going to tell us a lot about some exact properties of the theory. Okay, very good. Let's keep going with this example and just expound on the points that I... pause. This is why this is the really formal way of seeing why supersymmetric theories don't have these ultraviolet UV sensitivity, right? All of the corrections, there's no corrections of the superpotential. All the corrections are wave function normalization. Yeah, so therefore, there's no ultraviolet sensitivity. Everything is at most a logarithmic divergence. Okay? Is that clear? All right. Yeah, I encourage you to work through an example here with two chiral superfields, and then you'll see how the general thing goes. Okay, now, so this tells us something remarkable then, that at any loop order, I'm going to have phi dagger phi, and in front of this, there's going to be some function of lambda and lambda dagger, right? Now, intuitively, you sort of know that it's got to be lambda dagger lambda somehow. But, well, actually, how do you know that? How do I know I can't have a lambda squared plus lambda dagger squared here? Okay? We're making our living in this business off of the various spurious U1 symmetries. I use one of them. Let me use it again. And in fact, let me put here, there's also a wave function normalization, right? I didn't put it in. We normally put z equals 1, but let me put it in. Z, and just like last time, let me in fact call it e to the v. Okay, so this is just, in the original theory, the original cutoff scale, this is just some number or some background superfield. But, once again, there's a symmetry under v goes to v plus lambda dagger, phi goes to e to the minus lambda phi, and lambda goes to e to the 3 lambda, little lambda. Okay? So this is just a background. If I do all these rescalings, I haven't changed the Lagrangian at all. So that tells me that the at any scale, at any other scale, the Lagrangian, there's going to be a piece that looks like phi dagger e to the d phi. This is already has no charge. So if this is going to be a function of lambda, it's got to be a function of lambda dagger e to the minus 3b lambda. Because that's the combination which is invariant. Okay. Of course, you recognize this as the physical coupling constant, right? So when you have z phi dagger phi and lambda phi cubed, if I didn't tell you any fancy superspace crap, you would say, oh, phi is 1 over root z phi canonical. So you write this as phi canonical dagger phi canonical plus lambda over root z cubed phi canonical cubed, right? So this is the physical coupling constant, but it's useful for us to write that in this fancier way for a reason that we'll see momentarily. Okay, very good. These tiny chunks. Wait. Okay. So this tells us something. So I can write this whole thing then. This is the original B. So let me write this new thing. So I started off at the scale, some cutoff scale lambda. This is the effect of Lagrangian at the cutoff scale mu. This is V at lambda. Okay. So let me write this whole thing as phi dagger e to the V at mu phi. Okay. So I'm just absorbing log of F into V. So I can write down the renormalization group equation for V. And well, this is something, right? This is some function, gamma, of lambda dagger e to the minus 3V lambda. Okay. This gamma, so this is, again, if there was no fancy superfield crapola, this would just be mu dv mu log Z. And that's defined to be the anomalous dimension. Okay? Gamma of lambda physical squared. Okay? So gamma is the anomalous dimension. And what I want to stress is that this function gamma I can compute supersymmetrically. Okay? I can compute this theory in a theory where all these things are numbers, So I just computed it, for example, just by however you want. Compute the wave function normalization for the scalar or the fermion. Okay. So I can compute gamma at one loop, for example. In this theory, gamma at one loop is minus 1 over 16 pi squared lambda dagger e to the minus 3b lambda. So I just do this, for example, by computing this loop diagram. Okay. With UCalco. Okay, but now this is a supersymmetric computation. But since I know that the whole answer has got to look like this, even for V, a entire chiral superfield, I know more. I can, for example, take the theta squared theta bar squared component of the left and the right. Okay, so the theta squared theta bar squared component of the left is the soft mass. Then I just have to take the theta squared theta bar squared component of the right. Well, so this is just gamma of lambda dagger e to the minus 3v lambda, the theta squared theta bar squared component. Okay. So this is gamma of lambda dagger e to the minus 3, the lowest component of v, times e to the minus 3 theta squared theta bar squared m squared. So this is gamma of lambda dagger e to the minus 3v lambda minus 3 theta squared theta bar squared m squared times lambda dagger e to the minus 3v lambda. And if I expand this, there's the lowest component, the theta squared theta bar squared component. This comes from the Taylor expansion, and I get that mu dm squared d mu is the derivative of the anomalous dimension with respect to lambda squared times 3 lambda squared m squared e to the minus 3v. And of course, this combination is lambda physical squared, so let me call it lambda bar squared. So this is gamma prime 3 lambda bar squared m squared. This is an exact formula to all orders of perturbation theory. If you know the supersymmetric anomalous dimension, you know how the theory runs in the supersymmetric limit, then you know exactly what the RGE is for the soft term. Okay? You just have to provide me gamma. This shows the power of thinking about the soft parameters as background chiral superfields. Once you know the answer in the supersymmetric theory, you just continue everything into superspace and you read everything off from the higher components of the supersymmetric formulas. Okay, so in this case, but let's also see some of the physics. So in this case, since I know what gamma is, that immediately tells me that mu dm squared d mu in this theory is 3 over 16 pi squared lambda squared m squared. Okay? And so this means that if I go from high energies to low, this is decreasing the m squared. So that's one important bit of physics. Yukawa couplings decrease soft masses. Okay? Actually, if you like, you don't even have to write the RGE. You can just solve this equation trivially, exactly, okay, at one loop. You can just analytically solve this, continuing the superspace, and not only do you have the RGE, you have the actual solution of the RGE immediately. All right, let's keep going. So this example is even more trivial and more pretty. What about Gugino masses? How do Gugino masses run? Well, remember that the Gugino masses were the theta squared component. There's the theta angle, but then there's the theta squared component of the superfield that is the component of W, sits in front of W squared. All right? Now, how does S run? Well, we know S just runs at one loop. 1 over G squared goes to 1 over G squared minus beta function log. Right? Or I can write down the RGE if I want. Well, however I want. S at a scale mu is S at lambda minus beta function over 8 pi squared log lambda over mu. Okay, so let's continue this into superspace. So let me take the theta squared component of both the left and the right. So the theta squared component of the left is m over g squared, the Gugino mass over g squared at the scale mu. The theta squared component of this guy is m Gugino over g squared at the scale lambda. The theta squared component of that guy is, doesn't have one. It's a number. So that's the solution. M over g squared doesn't run. Okay? So that's a very pretty thing to remember. Okay? M over g squared, it doesn't run. The Gugino mass is always proportional to g squared in such a way that m over g squared does not run. This is at one loop. Okay? Let's do another example. What about, we just talked about when we have chiral superfields that have a Yukawa coupling, what about charged chiral superfields? Suppose I have a chiral superfield which is charged on, so you know, I have a gauge interaction for some chiral superfield. So I can look at the wave function normalization from the gauge interactions. So there's a one loop anomalous dimension, which is the one over eight pi squared. So this is just, again, it's straight supersymmetric, or in this case, it's just not even supersymmetric because there's anyway. Okay. So this computation gives me 1/8 pi squared times twice the quadratic Casimir of whatever representation. Let's say this chiral superfield is the representation R, twice the quadratic Casimir of R times G squared. So that's what it is supersymmetrically. Okay. Plus sign. Okay, so how do we, so this tells us that mu, dv mu of vr, for this representation r, from the gauge field is 1/8 pi squared, 2cr. Now what is g squared? What does g squared continue to? Remember, s is 1/g² plus I theta angle, blah, blah. S dagger is 1/g² minus I theta angle plus blah, blah. So clearly the g squared is s plus s dagger. It can't know anything about the theta angle. Okay. So it's a function of s plus s dagger. Oh, and this was 1/2g². So this is really 2cr over s plus s dagger. So that's, again, I go from, or in general, this is gamma of 1/s+s dagger. Okay. That's what it is at one loop. All right, now let me take the theta squared theta bar squared component, and I get mu dd mu of m in representation r squared is, well, this is 1/1/g² plus theta squared m gauge geno over g squared plus theta bar squared m gauge geno star over g squared. And if I expand this out, it has a theta squared theta bar squared component from the square of this term. Okay. And it comes in with a minus sign. Oh, so this is times 2cr over 8 pi squared. So this is minus cr over 8 pi squared 4g squared and get genos. So once again, from the supersymmetric computation tells me what the non-supersymmetric things are. And the important thing about this is that, so this is Yukawa couplings, and you see that it has the opposite sign as this does. So the Gaugino masses drive up the soft masses for scalar fields. Now, obviously, these things could be, this is just a slick way of computing them. You should also keep in mind where they come from in a dumber way. They come from in a dumber way. For example, the scalar mass is coming from diagrams that look like this. So if I have phi, there's the gauge Yukawa coupling, okay? And so where this is coming from is that I have some supersymmetry breaking mass term for the Gaugino. These are Weyl diagrams, but now in order to attach it to a phi going out again, I have to do it again to bring it back. Okay, so there's the two Gaugino masses and the two powers of g. Okay, so there's clearly some running contribution that goes like g squared and Gaugino squared. But anyway, this is a very fast way of understanding and getting the answer. Huh? Sorry? Which beta is that in? If it's non-abelian, yes. Yeah. But it doesn't matter. If it's abelian or non-abelian, this is it. Okay, so this is what scalar masses do, and the m's just follow the g squared. Okay, so m over the Gaugino masses are just flat. Okay? that's everything you need to know about the RGEs. Now, in fact, let me just, this is a parenthetical comment. This is all at one loop. There's no subtleties or anything at one loop. Everything is totally fine. As an exercise for you, use these methods to analytically solve the MSSM one-loop RGEs. It's a five-line exercise, okay? So you can analytically solve the MSSM RGEs so do it. At least in the limit where the only, Yukawa coupling you consider is the top Yukawa coupling. In that limit, it's particularly trivial. So you can do it in Mathematica, you can have it on your laptop so that, you know, when data starts coming out and you want to know what the soft mass looks like at a high scale, you don't have to ask your fancy SUSY phenomenology experts. You can just plug it into your little formula. Okay? Very good. So let me just say there's a nice exact story, and I'll just give you the answer. And you can look in the literature for where it comes from. I've just told you how to continue supersymmetric results into superspace and get exact results for everything else. So I want to tell you what the general rule is that's true to all orders of perturbation theory. And this reflects, again, the power, ultimately, of holomorphy in these background symmetries. They're really exact things that you can say in supersymmetric theories to all orders of perturbation theory. And I just want to tell you what they are. All you have to do is the following. Take a SUSY result that you like. Oh. Okay? So it'll depend on coupling constants and various. Wave function and normalization factors.
That was a cutoff on your lecture.
Yeah, that's true. Okay? So it depends on these things in the supersymmetric.
the
yellow ones were a little better. God. You know what? this truck didn't want to be tortured, so it jumped out of my hand. Ah, here's a Barney chuck. Let me choose Barney chuck. Okay. No? You can't see it. All right. I'll be gentle. So I just have to tell you how to continue these things into superspace. And so here's the rule. Well, Z, or Z for anything, or either the V for anything. OK, so the Z just goes to superfield Z. So that's just what we're doing. 1 over G squared goes to the following interesting object. Goes to something we call the real superfield, mu. And this is the following amusing object. Really? How about brown?
No.
No? Yellow? Okay. This is S plus S dagger, and the Hollywood S is, plus the Dinkin index for the gauge group. Log S plus S dagger minus the sum over all the representations PR log ZR over 8 pi squared. I will tell you in a second where it comes from. Okay. Now that S is just something that runs at one loop. So S at mu is just S at lambda minus the beta function coefficient, the one loop beta function coefficient log lambda over mu. Okay? But this S contains the Gugino mass in it. All the rest of the rules are the same. And so the claim is if you take any supersymmetric result and make these replacements, you're now saying an exact statement to all orders of perturbation theory about everything else. Let's see. Oh, chartreuse. That's wonderful. Okay. Now, these things reflect anomalies. Okay, and that's all I'll say about it. That's all I have time to say about it. there's known exact statements. For example, these statements contain the so-called Nabokov, Shiffman, Weinstein, Zakharov exact beta functions, even in the supersymmetric limit. Okay? These statements just contain that as a subcase, and they extend those into superspace. And they reflect anomalies which are calculable at one loop. So it looks like there are some one-loop corrections to things, and you might wonder why there aren't other corrections, and that's because really these things are controlled by anomalies. Okay, but I didn't want, that's all I'll say about it, but I just wanted to see how simple it is. Okay. So this is now true at all orders. So, okay. Huh? Oh, this is the trace TATA for any representation is T of the representation. The chasm, the Dinkin index. All right, very good. Now, these methods are not only, this way of thinking about soft terms is not only useful for running and things like that, that's the kind of most trivial application of them. They're also quite useful as a way of thinking about all supersymmetry breaking effects. In some systematic power series expansion, in any case. Okay. So I just wanted to do two examples quickly. All right. So let's imagine. You know what? Let me not. But I want to do it, but I don't have time. All right, I'm not going to do it. I'll do one example. I'll do part of one example. Suppose you have a theory. In the case where we care about for application in the real world, this is called gauge media. Okay. But remember we said there's a theory where you break supersymmetry in some sector, and then that information somehow gets transmitted to the sector that we care about. So here's a very simple example for what that could look like. Imagine we have some heavy fields. So, but for the purpose of my exercise, let me just imagine I have a U1 gauge theory. Okay, the U1 gauge theory. There are some very heavy fields which have mass m, so let's call them capital Q. Okay? There are some light fields, little q, which have, there are some light fields, little q. These things have charge 1 and minus 1, 1 and minus 1 under this U1. In the case of the MSSM, this would be the full S2 cross S2 cross U1, and we'd have some vector-like fields that are charged under the standard model. But they're very heavy. Okay? They're very heavy. But, you remember we had something that broke Suzy? Well, let's say there's some interaction between that X that broke Suzy and these fields. Okay? So now when X has an F component, now there is Suzy breaking. You know, the spectrum of these Qs and Q conjugates is non-supersymmetric, right? It's non-supersymmetric. So you would expect that if you integrate out these heavy fields, you would generate, in the low energy theory, some operators that would bring the information of Suzy breaking. You'd generate those operators that we talked about yesterday in complete generality. You would generate such operators. OK? Everyone happy with that? All right. Now, but you see, this is also a case where we can, so what should it look like? Well, if I put X to its F component, then this is generating for me some kind of non-supersymmetric mass term for the scalars that links Q and Q conjugate together, right? That's what this interaction would look like. If I put that theta squared, I just pull out the scalars from here, so it looks like Q conjugate Q. And this would be lambda times the F component of X. So let's just draw. What are some diagrams that we can draw which would, again, just being naive, which would generate masses for the other fields in the theory? Well, one of the fields is the Gugino of this U1, right? So if I'm going to integrate out these heavy fields, let's say I have the Gugino on the outside, and here I have the field, the fermion in Q. Here I would have the scalar in Q, right? But to get a Gugino mass, I need to have a diagram where there's a lambda coming in from the other side. It's got to be lambda, lambda. So how can I possibly hook these up together? I can't just keep going like that. That would give me an arrow in the other direction. That would be a wave function normalization type thing. Okay. So what do I have to do? Well, I have to switch the sign of these arrows. So I can do that by using a mass term here to flip Q to Q conjugate. Okay, but how do I flip the sign of the scalar? I flip the sign of the scalar by using this non-supersymmetric interaction to flip a Q to a Q conjugate. Okay? So this should generate a Gugino mass, and the Gugino mass that it should generate just schematically should look like G squared over 16 pi squared m lambda. It should be proportional to this, to the product of these two things. So it should look like lambda fx times m. But this is also, there are heavy particles in this loop, right? There are some very, very heavy scale. So just in order to, this has mass dimension 3 upstairs. So just in order to have the right mass dimensions, I have to have an m mod squared downstairs. So at the end of the day, this is a Gugino mass that looks like g squared over 16 pi squared, lambda fx over m. Okay? What about the scalars? These scalars, these light scalars, these guys are called messengers for obvious reasons, because they're the messengers, using the gauge interactions, they're the messengers of supersymmetry breaking for these light fields. What about the little q's here? What do you mean, 1, 2?
Over there.
Isn't there? What do you mean?
The top board.
The top board is... Oh, really? Is there? No.
I, we're not pitching
it. No, I see. All right. Let me just go. No. Okay, so... So, for those scalars, we have a diagram that looks like this. It's more complicated because you see they have the gauge interactions. So you have the squark Q, for example. But now here they have to see a loop. So here, for example, they have to see that supersymmetry breaking. So what they have is a loop of the Q and the Q conjugate again, but here I have Q, let's say, and it's got to flip to a Q conjugate, but now it's really got to flip back. This is a scalar line. So it's got to flip again to a Q. Here's a Q, for example. This is one contribution to the diagram. So this now gives me M squark squared goes like G squared over 16 pi squared squared, okay? And now it has two factors of this lambda fx squared, which has dimension 4, over m squared. Okay. So this is coming from some two-loop diagram. The Gugino mass comes from some one-loop diagram. And so notice, therefore, that means that nicely, the Gugino and the squarks are about comparable, about the same. Because one of them is squared, and it's two loops. The other one is not square, then one loop. Okay, so there's a generalization of this to the MFSM. This is one of the very popular ways of breaking supersymmetry. You'll notice, it goes like some F over M exactly as we said it should. So everything is like we said yesterday. This is a special case of the sort of thing we said yesterday. That M doesn't have to be incredibly high. So if that M could be, I don't know, 10 TeV, 100 TeV, 1,000 TeV. And if it's 10 or 100 or 1,000 TeV, the Fs are pretty low in order for those numbers to come out close to the TeV scale. So these are also theories where the Goldsteino is light, and so everything eventually decays to a Goldsteino. Okay. But what I want to say is this is a nice example where, you know, it looks like you have to do a lot of hard work to compute that two-loop diagram. In fact, that's how it was done originally. And this one-loop diagram, this is again a case where everything comes from just extending supersymmetric result into superspace. Let me show you how it's done for the Gugino mass, and I'll leave you to do it for the scalar mass. Once again, the trick is to notice that this, well, I can just put m plus lambda x together and call it one big happy chiral superfield m sitting in front of q conjugate q. Okay? And now let me just compute what the things look like in the low energy theory as a function of m. Well, let's say I'm up here. Let's say I have n of these fields, even. Okay. Let's say I'm up here, up at the cutoff lambda. I have a theory of n plus 1 charge fields. Okay. Beneath the scale m, I have a theory of 1 charge field. So here I have the q's and the q's, and here I have just the q's and their conjugates. Okay? So what is the gauge coupling? So what is the gauge coupling? What is 1 over g squared at some low scale mu here? Well, it's whatever it was at the cutoff. And then if I'm just running at one loop, I run at one loop from the cutoff down to the scale m using the beta function of the high energy theory over 8 pi squared log of lambda over m. And then I keep going from there to there using the beta function of the low energy theory. Okay? That's the supersymmetric one loop computation. Clear? Okay, but what I'm interested in, and so this dependence on m is reflecting that I've integrated out these heavy fields. All right? Now I'm interested in knowing what are the Gugino masses down here. Well, so how do I do that? Well, I just extend m to be a full chiral superfield and take the theta squared component of the resulting thing. Okay. And so you can see that if I say, if m goes to m plus theta squared lambda fx, which is what it was, then log of lambda over m goes to log of lambda over the script m, which is log of lambda over m one plus theta squared lambda fx over m, which is log of lambda over m minus log of 1 plus theta squared lambda fx over m. And I expand the log, so this is this minus theta squared lambda fx over m. And there's no higher orders. Okay? And, well, I get the same thing with log m over mu, then goes to the same thing, log m over mu plus theta squared lambda fx over m. So immediately, that tells me that the Gugino mass, without doing any work, other than the supersymmetric work, I learned that the theta squared component of S, which is m Gugino over g squared, is equal to the difference between the high energy and low energy beta functions over 8 pi squared lambda fx over m. And that's exactly right. Okay. And similarly, what's more surprising is that I can do the same computation keeping track of the wave function normalization, v, for the light fields. The v for the light fields is log z at the scale mu is the integral from the cutoff to the scale m d mu over mu times the anomalous dimension of the high energy theory. Plus the integral from m to mu times the anomalous dimension of the low energy theory. And these anomalous dimensions, remember, the gammas are just 2c over s plus s dagger. So I'm not changing what the, it's the same c. The only thing which is changing is that the s plus s daggers are different, are running differently in the low energy theory as in the high energy theory. OK? Because the beta functions are different. Now, once again, you elevate m to a chiral superfield. And this one loop result, you just have to extract the theta squared theta bar squared components. Okay? And the one loop result gives you the right answer. Oh, I should say, here, what should m be continued to? For the same sort of symmetry reasons that we talked about, it should be continued to square root m dagger m. Not square root m dagger m. And that's where the theta squared and theta bar squared will come from. But this one loop result, analytically continued, actually gives you the two loop answer, finite two loop answer. And the answer turns out to be that scalar masses in any representation m are, once again, if there's n messengers times alpha squared over 8 pi squared times lambda f over m squared. So it's two loops and it's positive. So that's why gauge mediation is very nice. What we did before was just estimates, but it would have been a disaster if the signs were wrong. But the signs are actually correct. And in fact, you know, these sorts of methods, you can build very complicated theories of Susie breaking if you like, I don't know why you'd want to, where you get something mediated from this sector to another one and from here to there, blah, blah, blah. What are the soft masses? And if you now draw the diagrams, you can quickly see that here it was a two-loop diagram. But if there's yet another stage of mediation, it could be a three-loop diagram, five-loop diagram. They're all a fake. All of these higher loop diagrams are really one loop supersymmetric calculations appropriately continued into superspace. And you can do them all on this one. Oh, yes?
And what is the affine Blass equation?
Oh, this is the gauge couple. I'm sorry. I just chose to write it this way. G squared over 4 pi.
Okay.
Sorry. All right. So that's one example. Another nice example that I'll just say very quickly is suppose you have a theory. I'll say this very quickly. This is what I'm about to tell you is a kind of rock bottom kind of supersymmetry breaking that you should expect in any theory. And there might be larger supersymmetry breaking effects than this one. But suppose we go back to that picture and we say that Susie's broken here and we have us. And let's say there's just no interactions at all between these sectors, none. Okay, so, all right, well then clearly there's no supersymmetry breaking here. But there is always gravity. Okay, so there's always gravity. And so there is a rock bottom amount of Susie breaking, which is, there are small loopholes to this argument, but anyway. There's a rock bottom amount of Susie breaking, which is induced by the mere fact that Susie's broken somewhere. And that arises in the following way. This is called anomaly mediation. And normally, anomaly mediation is explained by invoking some formalism for supergravity. But in fact, it's not a very, well, it's fine, but there's a more physical way of talking about it. But I will have to necessarily be brief and then give you the simple summary. You see, something we didn't talk about is the fact that when supersymmetry is broken, the vacuum energy is positive. Okay? Well, that's a disaster because in our world, the vacuum energy is almost zero, or it's very tiny. That's not a problem because in the presence of gravity, it's possible to have supersymmetric theories, not just in Minkowski space, but in theories with negative cosmological constant as well. Okay? So you can have a theory that's supersymmetric in anti-de Sitter space. And that follows, I'm sure Frederick talked about this, that follows technically because in supergravity there's another correction to the scale of potential, which is negative definite, minus 3w squared contribution, and so on. But all you really need to know is that it's possible to have supersymmetric theories in anti-de Sitter space. Now, something you know about an anti-de Sitter space is that that scalars and fermions and particles of different spin have different couplings to the background metric. Different forms of couplings to the background. And if you know a little bit about ABS, you know, for example, scalars can have negative mass squares a little bit in ABS and still not be unstable because of this coupling to the curvature, whereas, you know, fermions will be massless. Okay. So that means that in ABS space, if you were to just expand the Lagrangian like an idiot and stare at the quadratic components, you will find different, in the supersymmetric theory, if you have massive fields, you will find different coefficients in the mass terms for the scalars and the fermions. Of course, it's okay, because it's ABS space. That's what supersymmetry looks like in ABS. It's not what supersymmetry looks like in flat space. Okay, so just keep that in mind for a second. Now, let's say we're breaking supersymmetry here. Well, we're getting a positive vacuum energy. So how the hell are we going to get a negative? How are we going to get a zero vacuum energy? Well, we somehow have to imagine that we're actually starting with a theory that in the supersymmetric limit, suppose it had a supersymmetric vacuum. Like in our, remember, we saw generically there was always a supersymmetric vacuum. Okay? So suppose there was a supersymmetric vacuum. The supersymmetric vacuum would be in ADS. The supersymmetric vacuum would have negative energy. And the non-supersymmetric one would add some vacuum energy and make it zero. But the supersymmetric theory is beginning in ADS space. Okay? Is that clear? Now, these two sectors are not talking to each other at all. But they do talk to each other in just one way. They both live in the same space-time. Okay? So suppose here, in this theory, we have standard model fields, but we also have heavy fields. All sorts of stuff that has to be there in order to UV complete the standard model. Okay? For example, whatever UV completes just the logarithmic divergences, whatever. If there's some heavy fields out there, let's call them stringy modes or polyvillage fields or regulators or whatever the hell you want to call them. There are some massive modes out there that in the supersymmetric vacuum, okay, the theory is supersymmetric, but if you stared at the Lagrangian, they would have these different coefficients for the bosons and the fermions, which is, of course, what's supersymmetric in ABS. Now what's happening is in this supersymmetry breaking vacuum, the sectors are not directly talking to each other at all. Okay? In the supersymmetry breaking vacuum, now we're in flat space. But because there's no interaction between this sector and that sector, those Bose-Fermi non-degeneracies in the heavy fields that were supersymmetric in ABS are now supersymmetry breaking in flat space. So that's why it's possible, even when there's no interaction whatsoever between the sectors, if you break supersymmetry here, that you actually induce supersymmetry breaking there. Okay? It's because we have done a fine-tuning to cancel the cosmological constant. And these two things live in exactly the same space. Note this has nothing to do with graviton tree diagrams or graviton. It has nothing to do with the graviton at all. Okay? In fact, you can imagine taking a limit where you set G Newton to zero, keeping, and the Suzy breaking scale to infinity, keeping the ABS lengths fixed. And in that limit, you would still have some. Okay? All right, so what this means then is if I have some heavy fields out there that have a mass m, okay, those multiplets are getting split. They're getting split by supersymmetry breaking. And the only thing I haven't proven to you, but it's very plausible, is that that happens by, let's say I have some heavy chiral fields, which are regulated like Pauli-Villars fields, or stringy modes, or whatever. And this is the beauty. It doesn't matter what they are. These heavy fields have some Suzy breaking in them, now thought of in flat space, which just corresponds to turning them into 1 plus theta squared times something. And the something here is the ABS curvature. Okay? And the ABS curvature is actually the same as what you call the gravitino mass in the flat space theory. Okay, so this is a measure of the Suzy break. So that's what's going on. When you break Suzy in another sector, but you fine-tune the cosmological constant, what it looks like is the same theory. The massless modes, nothing changed. But it looks like in the massive regulator modes, you've shifted all the masses by a universal factor. Ah, it's universal because it's just coming from the background space-time. It was what the masses were in the background ABS. So it's the same factor for everything. And that's crucial. Because it's the same factor for everything, it just looks like conformally, it just looks like rescaling everything by exactly the same factor. Okay. Now, this is very important because any physical quantity in the low energy theory is going to depend on ratios of mu over m. Right? These are some regulars. So everything physical at some scale mu is really a function of mu over m, which means that I can equivalently think of this as being mu 1 minus theta squared m 3 halves over m. Okay? So instead of imagining analytically continuing what's going on in the UV, where I have no idea what it is, but because of dimensional analysis, I know that it's really exactly the same as analytically continuing the scale, mu. So this tells us that this is a sort of supersymmetry breaking, which is universal. It's always there. It's the rock bottom thing that you get by just having no interaction at all between the sectors. And we also learn how to compute it. We compute it by taking the supersymmetric limit for any quantity and analytically continuing the scale itself, mu, to be 1 plus theta squared and 3 halves. And so let me just give you what the answer is for that. So for example, log z, which is a function of mu, goes over into log z of mu square root of, so if I call this factor, well, anyway. So this is really log z of root mu dagger mu, where mu is now this promoted chiral superfield. And so if we can just expand this, this is log z of mu minus the derivative of log z with respect to mu, m3 halves theta squared plus Hermitian conjugate, plus the derivative of the derivative of z, which is the anomalous dimension dot of mu over 4, m3 halves squared, theta squared, theta bar squared. That just comes from doing this extension and expanding. So that tells us immediately that the scalar masses at the scale mu are given by minus gamma dot of mu over 4 times this m3 half squared. Not even an RG. I just tell you at any given scale exactly what is the soft mass, okay, up to an overall factor. Similarly, I can work out the A terms by looking at the theta squared component. So there's some A terms at a scale mu, which are just minus gamma I over 2, m3 halves. And by exactly the same trick, the Gugino masses are minus the beta function over 2g squared times m3 halves. So once again, the gamma dots go like two loop factors. The gammas are like one loop factor. The beta is like one loop factor. So this once again gives you everything down from one loop factor relative to m3 halves. Okay? And it's completely calculable. This is what's remarkable about this, is it does not matter at all what's going on in the ultraviolet. It's totally ultraviolet insensitive. The soft masses are totally determined just at any given scale by the structure of the low energy Lagrangian at that scale. Okay? So this is called anomaly mediation. This is also very popular, and it would have been clearly the right answer if it was not for the unfortunate fact that given what we know about the MSSM, the sleptons here, the gamma dots, are positive, so the slepton masses are negative. And that's a disaster. Okay. But so these are two simple examples of mediation mechanisms. They also run the gamut, by the way, as far as what the gravitino is. This is about the heaviest ever people ever imagined the gravitino, because here the gravitino is around 100 TeV, okay, because everything has a loop factor down from the gravitino. In gauge mediation, the Goldstino or the gravitino was very, very light. Okay. But in any case, so these are two very nice and very calculable and physically motivated methods of mediation. Yes?
In this for Mullins and the X sector, the hidden sector is ABS space. So, now you consider a higher dimension.
No, there's nothing higher dimensional. The intuitive question is, why? If Susie's broken there, why does it affect me here? Right? And the answer is, in fact, let's say that you started in flat space. Okay? So in fact, this is a very clear way of saying it. Suppose we didn't care about the real world for a second. Okay. Suppose we're just starting in flat space, and I bring Susie over there. Great. Okay. If I do that, then this effect is not there. Now the whole thing lives in de Sitter space. Okay, there was some contribution from graviton exchange, graviton loops, and so on. That's not this. Okay. This effect is not there. There's no direct coupling, and this effect isn't there. Okay. This effect is really only there because of the fact that to get flat space, the supersymmetric limit of this theory is ABS. And so if I just looked at this sector has supersymmetric masses for the heavy fields. In ABS, those supersymmetric masses they're the same in ABS, they're different than flat space. Okay. And what I'm doing by breaking supersymmetry, I'm not changing this, but the things that were supersymmetric in ADS are no longer supersymmetric in flat space. And so that's why it looks universal like this, and that's why you get this result.
The point that I don't get is the parameter to, for example, if we send it to zero, we go to flat space with ordinary standard model, but when we send it, for example, to one, we get to this model. What is the parameter?
Sorry, I'm not sure what. You see, what I'm doing is I have to control, and this is the reason you're not seeing a parameter. The reason you're not seeing a parameter is because I have some amount of Susie breaking, and I have to choose very correctly which ADS I start with, okay, in order to cancel that exactly. That's why you're not seeing a parameter. So I've done that. I've made that choice in order to end up in flat space. So this is really, again, as I said, it's a consequence of fine-tuning to end up in flat space. That's why I gave you the example. If you start in flat space, let's say, and you just break supersymmetry, you don't care about fine-tuning anything. There's no such effect. Okay. And the reason you're not seeing a parameter is no matter how, for whatever Susie scale, you pick a very specific ADS in order to make it flat space. But then that specific ADS gives you a very specific Bose-Fermi splitting in the heavy regulator fields, which then mediates that. Okay.
So, yeah. Possible in this case, sort of add a bit of gauge in each to Q in this program.
You can try to add all sorts of things. You can try to add, but the one thing you cannot do, I mean, you really have to have a different source of Suzy breaking, which is there. So that's one thing you could try. People have tried all sorts of things, combining all sorts of things. I'm just giving you two examples and also showing you, I mean, these are also two nice examples where this general way of thinking about the soft terms is very useful and very simple to get the right answer. These are two of the most popular ways of talking about Suzy breaking. The third most popular way is what we basically did. You just write down higher dimension operators by hand, okay? Just write down, and they all look the same anyway, right? At low energies, it all looks the same, as I emphasize. It all looks the same, but what people call gravity mediation from the old days, so that's anomaly mediation, we did gauge mediation, what people call gravity mediation from the old days is more or less the same as writing down operators, x dagger x over m Planck squared, where the scale is m Planck, okay? That's what's called gravity mediation. As you see, it's a little bit of a fake. There's no mediation. That's just higher dimension operators. And that's a case where the gravitino is comparable to the other guys, okay? Because gravitino mass is F over M Planck. All the other soft masses are F over M Planck. So that's a case where the gravitino is comparable to everyone else. Okay? So we really don't have to do that case because it's kind of true. Oh, great. So it is possible to do all the mediation mechanisms in 15 minutes. That's really all the interesting ones there are. Gauge mediation, anomaly mediation, gravity mediation. All right, but you actually don't need to really understand any of that. Okay, so let me, finally, let's talk about the actual MSSM. Any questions about this, by the way? Yes?
Why anomaly?
Why is it called anomaly mediation? I guess it's because all the soft masses here, as you see, are proportional to beta functions and gamma functions, right? And it's called anomaly because if scale invariance was a good symmetry, all of these things would vanish. So you see they would vanish if the betas and the gammas were all zero. And that's because all I'm doing is rescaling the regulator masses, or rescaling mu. So it's the scale anomaly. It's a scale anomaly. But it's a supersymmetric extension of the scale anomaly which is giving you all of these effects. So that's maybe why they call it a why my friends call it
anomaly. There were some complaints about the name.
Huh?
There were some complaints about the name.
Well, there's people complain about everything. Something you will learn in your life is that a reaction to any good idea, there's a universal reaction to any good idea from people who did not have the idea. It's trivial, it's wrong, and I did it first. Sometimes all three. Sometimes all three. Yes.
What about interactions in the scene sector and the small
I can. I will say one word about it. Sure. We have been. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter unless you. A sensible quantum field theorist would never run into the problem that they pointed out. Okay. So but let me just say it very, very quickly. When you write down these interactions like x dagger x over m squared, q dagger q, say, okay? Now, I just said, well, you just put the x's to their bad and that's it. Okay? Now, formally, what you should really do is start at the scale m and run this operator to low energies. And what can happen is that this operator requires interesting non-trivial scaling due to interactions in the hidden sector, in the scale, in this theory. Now, in the particular example that I showed you, this doesn't happen. In fact, it doesn't happen in a huge class of theories where the Suzy breaking is quite weakly coupled. Remember, I showed you any theory has got to look like what I wrote down for you at low energies. The only exception is it might be strongly coupled. If it's strongly coupled, then that's a somewhat different kettle of fish. But if it's weakly coupled, there are no renormalizable interactions for x. So this just, you don't care about it. Even if there are, then what you can always do is say, well, look, it doesn't matter. Because as long as I'm running down the most general soft terms consistent with symmetries, then all of these effects just go into a redefinition of what those soft terms were at some scale. Okay? So you really don't have to talk about it. You only have to talk about it if you think there are some fancy relationships between the soft terms at a high scale. Okay? If you believe there's a grand unified theory or there's something that makes them equal at some high scale, then if you care about keeping track of that relationship, then you would have to know about this effect. So that's the one case where you would care about it. You never care if you just say there's a different soft mass, you know, and so it only affects your theoretical extrapolation of whether these relationships are satisfied at high energies or not. Now, typically, again, in many, many theories, those relationships are violated anyway by other effects. And so, anyway, so it's not, it's a very basic fact about quantum field theory, which is very well known. Indeed, it affects people who care a lot about scalar mass unification, for example. And only in theories where the Suzy breaking is not weakly coupled in the way I described. All right, so I'm going to spend my remaining time talking about the MSSA.
In one, the principle expressed the divergence of the supersymmetric current to the energy momentum tensor trace in order to show that there's an anomaly related to a scale anomaly.
Well, that's what it is. This is I'm not sure what you mean, but it's just as explicit.
The supersymmetric
You can do such things, in practice, this is really what we're saying is a moral analog of using current algebra instead of Carle-Lagrangian standard stand quantum physics. Okay, and it's much easier to use Carle-Lagrangian. But it is a principle equivalent. If you're very careful, it's a principle equivalent. But many smart people were not careful enough doing it like that and got the wrong answer. But it is possible. It's definitely logically the same thing. All right. So finally, let's talk about the MSSM. So the MSSM is the supersymmetric theory we care about. We have to elevate all the standard model fields we know to a super field. So there's the 3-2-1 vector multiplet, and all of the fermions get elevated into chiral superfields. So these are now chiral superfields. So I have the vectors here, V3-2-1. These are chiral superfields. And the one thing which is interesting is the Higgs. So the Higgs is going to get embedded in the chiral superfield, but that means that the Higgs is going to have a fermionic partner. Okay? And if the Higgs is a fermionic partner, that means there's a doublet that carries hypercharge. So that theory is anomalous. So I can't have a theory with just one Higgs. Okay? I have to have two Higgses to cancel the anomalies. So they're conventionally called H up and H down for reasons that will become apparent in a second. But this is a doublet with hypercharge minus a half, and this is a doublet with hypercharge plus a half. Okay, in order to cancel the anomalies. Alright? Now remember back to the very, very first lecture. So you know, we've done all this beautiful theoretical structure. It's possible to remove UV sensitivity and scalar masses, possible to solve the hierarchy problem, all of those wonderful things. But remember, we started off in the very first lecture by seeing that, so supersymmetry is doubling the world at the TeV scale, right? Hard to imagine something more dramatic we could see. There's some more dramatic things we could see, but anyway. Doubling the whole world at the TeV scale, tons of new particles at the TeV scale. Lots of new particles at the TeV scale. You know, Maria will be fried with Luinos with her 30 inverse Pico barn. Lots and lots of new particles. But we also talked about the fact that the standard model is working damn well. And that if we, in fact, we've seen no direct or indirect evidence for anything beyond the standard model so far. Okay, very important. And furthermore, when we wrote down these higher dimension operators, they have to be suppressed by ridiculous scale. So varying the Lupton number, gut scale. Then we kept going, flavor, between 10,000, 1,000, 100 TeV. We kept going, CP, around 100 TeV. Okay? We kept going, even these kind of garden variety operators, contact operators, all these other operators, 10 TeV. Okay? So this fact is the central source of tension in physics beyond the standard model. It's the reason why the field exists. Okay? It's the reason why there's something to work on. Because on the one hand, you want to solve the hierarchy problem. Talk, we did it. But the problem is that now you've got to make sure, why haven't we seen it any of it? Okay. And this is it's non-trivial because the standard model gave us a beautiful explanation for all these accidental symmetries. And as we'll see, in every model of physics beyond the standard model, we lose those explanations and we have to invent new ones. Okay? So that was what people, and in fact, the whole history of the subject, starting from 1980, 1981, is about people obsessing over these problems in turn, starting with the worst ones and then going down. And at every time, it was the one that they were just hadn't solved that was occupying their mind the most, till the end of the 90s, where more or less, there was a story to say for all of them. And maybe you didn't like the story, but a story to say for all of them. And then something new started happening from data that made us realize, oh, the issue is really something completely else. Okay? So we're gonna go through some of that. I will at least tell you points. We'll talk about what all the parameters are, and I'll point you to what all the problems were that people obsessed about, and we'll wave at them as we pass them by. Okay? But I want to quickly take you to what the real issue is with these theories. Okay. So let's start. So this is a very nice theory. What can we have in the superpotential? Well, we can have the Yukawa couplings we knew in the standard model. So we can have Q lambda U conjugate H up. And now, by the way, this is another way of seeing that you need an H up and an H down. In the standard model, remember, the Yukawa couplings are an H star and an H. Okay, but we can't have an H dagger in the superpotential, so that's another reason we need two chiral superfields. Okay, so plus Q, lambda down, B conjugate, H down, plus L, lambda E, B conjugate, H down. Okay, so these are the interactions we know and love in the superpotential. Okay, yes? Yes, but we don't want to have the Higgs and hadron representation because then we don't have the Cassola-SA2 symmetry and we are really screwed very badly. Yes, it's because of the Cassola-SA2. Yes. Also, there's also a problem with the Yukawa couplings, but we also can't write down Yukawa couplings these things are doublets, these things are not, so this thing has to have a single SU2 index. So we have to do something else for fermion masses anyway. So, okay. So let me just remind you what everyone's quantum numbers are. So this is 3, 2, and 6. 3 bar, nothing, minus 2 thirds, just the standard model ones. Nothing, nothing, plus 1, nothing, nothing. Oh, doublet minus half. And here's H up, it's nothing doublet plus a half, and H down, nothing doublet minus half. Okay? So are there any other interactions that we can write down that are gauge invariant? And, there most certainly are. even without systematically writing them all down, one obvious set is that notice that H down and the lepton have identical quantum numbers. So I can just, everywhere I see a lepton or an H down, I can replace it with the other one. So here is an interaction, QLD. That's gauge invariant. LLE. That's gauge invariant. Okay? There's one more which is gauge invariant, actually, and which is pretty obvious as well. UDD. So this has three color indices that I can contract with an epsilon symbol. Okay, and it has the correct hyperchunk. Okay? Now, these are all terrible. This violates lepton number. This violates lepton number. This violates baryon number. Okay? So I told you that when you go beyond the standard model, you lose the explanation, this nice explanation for why everything is automatically fine. And here's an example. Here we lost it. In the standard model, all we have to say is declare the particle content. We get baryon number for free, and here it's not true. Okay? So this was the first problem people obsessed about. This was so bad, they had to solve it immediately before even getting off the ground. Okay? So they solve it by, and you can, as a nice exercise, put in the numbers. And you see that these coefficients of these operators have got to be really tiny, like 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 11, things like that. Really, really tiny coefficients. Why? Because, so by the way, how does it look in detail? For instance, from that UDD coupling, I get something that looks like a U, a D, and a D scalar. Right? And then from the QLD, I can use that same scalar to get a quark and a lepton. So there is our famous quark, 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 lepton type operator. Okay? There it is. It's a dimension 6 operator, as it should be. But instead of being suppressed by the gut scale squared, it's suppressed by the mass of the down squared. Okay? So the only way, if this was 1 over, that's got to be the gut scale. So therefore, the product of these two couplings, lambda 1, lambda 2, has got to be of order 10 to the minus 30 in order to make that viable. All right, so what people do is say that there's a symmetry. There's a discrete symmetry. Here it's called matter parity. Under which all the QLEs are, odd, and the Higgses are even. Okay? That Z2 symmetry forbids all of these operators. Okay? So this Z2 symmetry also ensures that, well, if there's that the lightest object charged under this Z2 is, is stable. Okay? You see, with this interaction, now all of the interactions in the Lagrangian involve the new supersymmetric particles in pairs. That is called R parity. It's not exactly the matter parity. That's called R parity, and this ensures that the lightest superpartner is stable. So there is something nasty. We really have to get rid of it. But there is a booby prize. The booby prize is that we get to have a stable particle that might be the dark matter that we thought we liked. Okay?
Why is it important to be stable?
Huh?
Why is it important to be stable?
Well, first of all, the second you have this parity, there is a stable particle. It's not important or not. I mean, it's there. And secondly, for it to be the dark matter, it has to be at least as long-lived as now. Right? Okay. Okay. And so these are all the dimensionless interactions that we have. So now we can easily talk about what the theory looks like at, I just want to make a quick general comment. This is a very generic fact about theories of physics beyond the standard model. And the reason is precisely because there's got to be, you probably have to impose Baryon and Lepton number in order not to break it very badly. Any theory that has new physics, that has Baryon and Lepton numbers as a good quantum number, and has a new fermion that is not charged under Baryon or Lepton number. Let's say you have such a theory, okay? So you have a new fermion not charged under Baryon or Lepton number. Of course, supersymmetry is filled with those. The Gaginos, Higgsinos, all these things are fermions not charged under Baryon or Lepton number. Okay, if you have any such fermion, it must be stable. And just think about it, it has spin a half. What could it decay to? The lightest, it has to decay to at least one object that has spin a half. What are the only light objects we know of that have spin a half? Proton and the electron. So it either has to violate Baryon number or it has to violate Lepton number. Okay? So that's why dark matter is so prevalent in physics beyond the standard model, because first of all, Baryon and Lepton number are damn good symmetries. And secondly, it's quite typical to just happen to have a particle that isn't charged under either one. All right, now, the most astonishing thing about this theory is the unification of couplings. Okay, so we've specified what the dimensionless parameters are. We can now run the theory to high energies. And when we run the theory to high energies, we find the picture that many of you have seen, that the couplings converge very accurately at high scales. Okay, to percentage level accuracy. By the way, what this really means, often people say, well, if you actually look, if you take these very well measured alpha 1 inverse and alpha 2 inverse, and you see where they meet, and then you run back to predict what alpha 3 inverse should be, it looks that alpha 3 inverse, okay, it's pretty close, but it maybe looks more like 10%. It doesn't look like 1%. It doesn't look like it's such an impressive thing. This is bullshit. It's bullshit because when you look at the plot, first of all, it's viscerally bullshit because when you look at the plot, these lines just run right through each other. It definitely doesn't look like some 10% thing. And unpackaging that feeling that it's not just a 10% thing is that really, really, this is predicting a correlation between two things. This picture of unification is predicting a correlation between the ratio of alpha 1 over n and alpha 2, or another way of saying it is sine squared theta, and alpha 3. Okay? So it's not just a one-dimensional prediction. It's a prediction in the two-dimensional plane of alpha 3 and sine squared theta. And the unified story with supersymmetry would tell you that the thing should be close to some line in this two-dimensional space, and you're close to the line like this. In one direction, the error bar is tiny, the error bar is a little bigger in the other direction, but you're just damn close to that line. There's no reason why you should be that close to the line, accidentally. Yes?
So, I think what you said, that it goes back and predicts that thing,
yes,
is within 1%.
That's not within 1%. No.
Yes, it's within the experimental measurement.
No, it is not. It's 118 is the experimental measurement, and the Suzy prediction is like 124. It's not within 1% at all. Nope.
But
it's 1% for sine squared theta. It's 1% for sine. If you do the other thing, so if you do the other thing, it's 1% for sine squared theta. It looks like 10% for alpha 3. Of course, the really crucial thing is it's 1% for something, and that's reflected in this picture. So really, these two ways of talking about it are just different projections of one two-dimensional state.
The question is, if you put the three lines in the standard model.
Yes, if you put the three lines in the standard model, it doesn't.
10% difference compared to what you see. Here, or not?
No, I mean, you know, that's the standard model is down here somewhere in such a picture. It's really quite far off in this picture. When you look at it visually, it looks more like that. So they have some tendency to come together, but it's not. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's pretty good still. The standard model is pretty good still. But the crucial thing about this is our motivations were solving the hierarchy problem. Okay. And this just comes out as a bonus. We didn't put it in, it comes out, and it's really remarkable. I want to unpackage a little bit I want to unpack it a little bit. I have a few minutes, but I want to. But this is important. I want to unpack it a little bit. What's really going into this? What aspect of the supersymmetric beta functions are really going into this calculation? Well, let's, in order not to write down equations, let's imagine that these running couplings are actually runners. Okay. Right. And let's jump into the frame of reference of the middle runner. Okay. So in the frame of reference of the middle runner, there's this runner at some distance coming with some speed, another runner another distance coming with some speed, and then the amazing thing is that they hit me at the same time. Okay. Now, in order for that to happen, clearly there's got to be some specific ratio of the velocity of this guy to the velocity of that guy. Only for some magic value of that ratio will they hit me simultaneously. So what matters for unification, is the difference in the beta function, the ratio of the difference between the beta functions. Okay? X's and Y's from guts are up here. They don't affect running in the low energy theory. Okay? So until I get there, they don't affect anything. This is that's heavy particles do not affect running. You integrate them out, you go to a new low energy theory. Okay, so unification depends on that ratio being some value. Now in SUSY, this value is 5/7. Okay, so that turns out with the observed values of the couplings at low energies, that turns out to be the ratio you need, and SUSY gets it to you very nicely. Okay? But notice, what are the particles? What's SUSY adding beyond the standard model? It's adding all the superpartners of the matter fermions, for example. It's adding gauginos, and it's adding the higginos and the second Higgs, compared to what we have just in the standard model. But notice, for example, all the standard model fermions themselves, they cancel out in V3 minus V2 and in V2 minus V1. That's because all the standard model fermions fill out a complete representation of SU5. So because they fill out a complete gut representation, they make equal contributions to V3, V2, and V1. That's the fast way of understanding it. So everything that makes equal contributions to V3, V2, and V1 is not going to affect any of this. This is very important. Unification depends, importantly, on split gut multiplets. Okay. Split got multiplets. So the standard model fermions never contributed to this. Therefore, none of the superpartners, none of the scalars contribute either. They're irrelevant as far as running is concerned. The things that are split are the gauge bosons themselves. We augment that in supersymmetry with the gauginos. And then the thing that actually does most of the legwork, it turns out, are the higginos. That's really the thing that's making the biggest difference in going from the standard model to a SUSY, is the higginos. Those are also split, okay? And that's really what's doing it. So it's the gauginos and the higginos which are really responsible for this. Of course, in low energy SUSY, there's no choice. They all come along for the ride in order to solve the hierarchy problem. Okay? But that's really what's actually going into getting you the prediction of unification. This also explains why it is that people can build so many models, where they say, oh, I have guts, I have gauge mediation, and this, and that thing, and Frog and Nielsen flavor, blah, blah, all of this crap that they populate the desert with. Okay, why can we populate this crap and still ride the high horse of unification? Well, we just have to declare that all of the new stuff comes in complete multiples of SU5. So it makes equal contributions to all the beta functions and doesn't affect unification. Okay. All right. So I will finish at 1. Because I do want to get to what the major outstanding issues. All right. So I'm going through the history. So Baran left the number of the first big problem. People impose R parity. They moved on. Another annoyance is that there's one other term in the superpotential that you can write down, which is a mass term between the higginos. Okay? Hexenos are vector-like, so there's a mass term for them. You might wonder, I can forbid this mass term by chiral symmetry. So you might wonder, is that consistent? Can I have that mu equal to zero? And it was consistent before 1997. Okay? The reason is that all of these objects get some mass from electroweak symmetry breaking. And so it was possible that hexenos had a mass comparable to the W mass before LEP2, but that possibility was ruled out immediately after LEP2. So it's just phenomenologically impossible not to have such a mass. Okay? So we must have such a mass. Okay, so we have this together with everything else that we had before. So this is called the mu term, and then people obsessed for a little while, why is this mu term not at the Planck scale? It's a vector-like mass, we're allowed to write it down, why isn't it at the Planck scale? Okay, well, this is not really a very big deal, okay? I mean, again, these were all things that was what people worked on, some of these things make work projects to some extent. Okay, so this is really not a very big deal. It's really easy to imagine that mu could be right. For example, you can have tiny extensions of the theory. Here's one. Instead of having a mu, have a field S. Okay? So now there's no mu. Impose this chiral symmetry that we talked about. Okay? But now have a field S. So this is the new field. Now we've gone to the MSSM to the next to MSSM. Okay? So what? It's a singlet. It's fine. And now, just like the Higgs is supposed to get a BEV around the weak scale after Suzy breaking, well, S will get a BEV at the weak scale after Suzy breaking too. Right? And then that solves the problem. And there are other ways that you can do it too. Okay? So I don't want to totally downplay this problem. There are aspects of this problem which are important. But again, I'm giving you a little tour because these are really not the. There's something much more structural and important that we've started confronting, as I said, in the last 5 years. Okay, let's keep going. So much for all the supersymmetric terms. So the mu problem was the one supersymmetric term. Now we have all the soft terms. So we have the soft terms for all the cutilies. We have the A terms, okay? For U, D, and E, associated with those Yukawa couplings. We have the B term, associated with the mu term, so we have a B mu H up H down, for example. These are, for example, A U, Squark U, Higgs up, and so on. These are MQ squared, Q dagger Q. Okay? Now let's look at these in turn. What's the problem? Remember, so we went from Baron Lepton number before, then the next set of things that hit us in going beyond the standard model was flavor. There are operators that violated flavor that have to be suppressed by more than 100, 1,000 TeV or so. So we said that's because the standard model has this beautiful feature that the only things that violate flavor are the Yukawa matrices. Okay. Well, there's now, here are 5 operators, MQ squared and U squared, up to ME squared, okay? These are operators that aren't even in the same representation as the Yukawa matrices, okay? The Yukawa matrices are like a 3-3 bar, or 3-3 under U3Q cross U3U, okay? MQ squared is an adjoint under U3Q alone. They don't even have the same quantum numbers as the Yukawa matrices. They certainly represent totally new directions in flavor space. Totally new spurions in flavor space. That's a disaster. That is a disaster. Okay? So we cannot have, the standard model is damn successful up to 1,000 TeV, only having things breaking flavor being Yukawa matrices. We can't introduce random other things that break flavor. Okay? So those are the next set of issues that people obsessed about. Oh, it's called the Suzy flavor problem. Right? And well, the Suzy flavor problem was all about trying to figure out a way to make this go away. So what you say is, well, maybe these things don't, so the most extreme thing you do is say these things don't depend at all on flavor. They're proportional to the identity matrix in flavor space. So we continue to have it be true that the only things that violate flavor are the Eucalypt interests. Okay? And then people tried to build theories that guaranteed that the scalar masses would look like that. That's why these ideas like anomaly mediation and gauge mediation are so nice, because there are cases where either it's coming through the anomaly or it's coming through gauge interactions, and so ultimately there's no extra breaking of flavor other than the ones in the Eucalypt interests. Okay? But again, while this was very important, many people worked on it and so on, this also has a little bit of ability to make work project because no one ever forces me. You know, there isn't a low energy reason I must have scalar masses which break flavor. I can always declare as a rule, the only things that break flavor are the Eucalypt matrices. That would force all these m squareds to be proportional to the identity, and that's it. Okay. So there was no one, there was never a rule that it has to happen. There was all some prejudice about what theories should look like at high energies and so on. So that's another 10 years of work. How do you build theories which guarantee that the m squareds don't have flavor violation? All right. Now, let's keep going down. One more level, CP. CP is a little more interesting. Let's say we've actually done this. So in principle, there's tons of sources of flavor violation, tons of sources of CP violation as well, for the same reason. But let's say that we've gone through making all of these things so there's no new sources of flavor. Now, we're still left with possible sources of CP violation. And in order to see that, let's see the quantum numbers. So I have, so instead of having the A's labeled by a lot of things, I just have some A parameter, some B parameter. And now let's see how they're charged under two interesting U1 symmetries. There's a U1R symmetry and a U1 H.A. Quinn symmetry. This U1PQ symmetry is something that rotates H up and H down by the same phase. And the U1R symmetry is one under which H up and H down have charge zero. So there are three, I'm not breaking flavor, so there's just A and B parameters. In principle, I have three gauge genome masses. And let's just look at what their charges are. All of these could, in principle, be complex parameters. Let's look at what their charges are. The A has R charge minus 2 and PQ charge 0. The B, actually, none of these things have PQ charge. Sorry, it doesn't matter. Oh, sorry. I don't know what I'm writing down the future charts. I was trying to write down mu. Oh, sorry. Mu is another thing that could be complex. Sorry. And it also has the following. It also has the following R charges and PQ charge. Okay. So this should be obvious. Mu is sitting in front of H up, H down. So mu should have R charge 2. It has a PQ charge of minus 2 because H up and H down have a charge 2. The gauge genome mass, of course, just has R charge minus 2 because the gauge genomes have R charge 1 and B and M. Now, so these are all the complex parameters that could be complex that I have left, but now I have to see whether there are combinations of them that are invariants under all possible symmetries I can use to rephase them by. And you can see there's very few of them, but there are some. For example, M gauge genome 1 star M gauge genome 2. In general, that could be complex. That could have a CP violating, that could have a CP violating phase in it, and so we're screwed. Those phases have to be less than a percent in order not to get large electric dipole moments and so on. Okay? So what do we do with that? Well, you need to have a theory which says that actually all the gauge genome masses are the same at some scale, or that all the gauge genome masses come from the same source at some scale. Let's say all the gauge genome masses were unified at some scale. Then M1 star M2 would just be M mod squared, and it would be real. Okay? So this motivates theories with single source for gauge genome masses, so that we can remove these CP violating phases. Okay? Then I have other invariants. See, what's nice is that there's nothing I can make just directly out of mu. It alone carries the PQ charge, so I can forget about mu. Then I have things like, so now let's say there is a universal gauge neural map, but I have things like M star B and M star A. Okay, so these are things that could be complex. I can't, so no reason I can. So I've made all the gauge neural maps the same. There's two phases left. And this motivates theories where, for some reason, at a high energy scale, B or A vanish. Okay? Perhaps because of some symmetry reason, B or A vanish at some scale. Okay? That's what you have to do in order to remove even the phases. Right? And that happens in gauge mediation, for example. Okay? When you look in a little more detail. But I'm just taking you through, as I said, we're waving at all these things as we go past them. So CP was, so CP isn't numerically as severe a problem as the flavor problem, but it bothers me a little more than the flavor problem does, actually. All right. So that's it. So if we do all of this, so we have the theories that have universal gauge neural masses and flavor blind, supersymmetry breaking, and vanishing A and B terms at a high scale, and our parity as a symmetry as a star, then we can have something which doesn't screw everything up at low energies. Okay? So you see, the attitude for 20 years was that we have to solve the hierarchy problem, of course, obviously. And then all of these facts that we're not seeing, these things are just hints about nice structure to the theory. They're an opportunity. It's not a problem. It's an opportunity. We're learning a lot. It's such a beautiful theory. It's a very beautiful theory, very simple theory. Universal this, that. We learn a lot about the structure. It's an opportunity. The flip side is maybe it's an excuse. Okay? And it's not obvious. But the issue became more pressing in the last number of years. And that's for a different reason altogether. And this is what's known as the little hierarchy problem. And this I can really do in 2 minutes, and then I will end with some inspirational comments. Okay. But since this is part of the point, I don't want to short this too much. The real problem is that we haven't seen superparticles. Okay? That is the real problem with supersymmetry. And the reason is, it's a problem, because, you know, we give these talks, we say, obviously, supersymmetry, the LHC is the machine to discover supersymmetry. Absolutely. Absolutely true. The reason it's absolutely true is that really supersymmetry is overdue. And it's not just the numerical problem. People say, the worst people say that many of you have probably heard is, supersymmetry is maybe fine-tuned at the few percent level. How many people have heard that kind of statement? Okay, people make that sort of statement. Now, you know, talking about fine-tuning, is 10% okay, 3% okay? This is not something intelligent people should do. Okay, it's really a stupid exercise, and it's all about, I don't know, it's a totally sociological construct. That when people argue with each other, they want to, you know, convince themselves whether model X or Y is right or wrong, and it's totally stupid because nature is going to tell us in a year and a half that model Z is right, and it doesn't really matter what you thought about models X and Y. Okay, but that's not the aspect I want to focus on in explaining the problem to you, but there's a more conceptual way of talking about the problem, which is, I think, a little more enlightening. You see, we just saw, this is one of the reasons I went through the running, we saw that what happens under renormalization group evolution is that, you know, due to gauge interactions and gluinos and gauginos, some scalars get heavier. Due to Yukawa coupling, some scalars get lighter. Okay? And actually what happens very nicely with a particular case of the Higgs mass squared parameter. Okay, So and furthermore, remember M over G squared for gauginos was a constant. So that means that that since the G for color is getting much bigger than everyone else, then naturally the gluino should be getting heavier than everyone else. The G for SU2 isn't changing very much at all. The G for U1 is getting weaker, so the U1 dot should be getting weaker. So this tells you to think that the colored gauginos should be a little heavier. The uncolored things should be lighter. This is a general supersymmetric fact. Colored things get heavier, uncolored things are lighter. And now as the gadolinos get heavy, well, they also drive up the squarks. So the galeno will make the squarks heavier. Okay? So again, and also just the gauge interaction itself, the squarks get heavier relative to the sleptones. So just a general, fact. You should expect colored things up here, uncolored things a little lighter. All right? Now this happens in almost everyone's theory. Now, what about the Higgs? What about the Higgs? Oh, you would think the Higgs is in color, so it should be down here. But in fact, the Higgs has the biggest coupling at all, of all. It has the top Yukawa coupling. Okay? And the top Yukawa coupling is bigger than everything else, and that dominantly controls its evolution. Now, the top Yukawa coupling is pinning and relating the mass of the Higgs with the mass of the stocks, because that's what's there in the in its evolution. And in fact, there's this picture I was about to draw where the Higgs mass rate, even if it starts off positive, gets driven negative by the presence of the large Yukawa coupling. And people even like this because it seems to give a reason that electric symmetry wants to break. This is a little bit of a fake, but anyway, it's really a fake. But anyway. Never mind. It doesn't matter for my argument. However, but really the point is because it has this big Yukawa coupling, it wants to be up where the squarks are, right? And its magnitude naturally wants to be up where the stops are. So that means that what you should expect for the spectrum, if someone just told you this was the theory, this is what you'd expect the spectrum to look like: squarks, galenos, colored guys up here, sleptons, weenos, other things down there, and the Higgs up here with these guys because of the top Yukawa coupling. Okay? That's the general expectation. Now, the Higgs mass parameter itself in SUSY directly determines the Z mass. Okay? That's natural because that's where the bed is coming from. So it directly determines the Z mass. That means that what you should have expected to see is also up around here, the Z. Okay. So this is what parametrically low-energy supersymmetry predicts. It predicts that the Z should be close to the top of the spectrum. This is why when people were looking for, this is why when LEP 1 turned on, very sober people, not, you know, not the very serious, sober Italian theoretical physicists were betting, you know, months of salary that supersymmetry would be discovered. They weren't just being wild optimists. It was for this reason. That's what supersymmetry wants to do. It wants to put the Z closer to the top of the spectrum, not even the middle, closer to the top of the spectrum. Okay? The parametric problem that we run into is that all of the data so far has shown us that exactly the opposite has happened. The Z is at the bottom of the spectrum. Okay? And so we have to try to understand what aspects, so either there's something wrong with these ideas, but how can there be something wrong? Maybe unification is so beautiful, all these totally beautiful things, but somehow, structurally, the theory is doing the opposite of what you would think it wants to do. It's putting the Z near the bottom of the spectrum rather than near the top of the spectrum. Now, I can translate this idea, this way of stating the issue, into the usual way of talking about it in terms of fine-tuning in the following way. See, this is what the picture of the running looks like, as I said. So up here, the Higgs mass is comparable to the stop masses. Down here, it's comparable to the stop masses. Okay? And, well, okay, around here, like right there, it's not comparable to the stop mass. But, you know, when I used to teach graduate students this in my courses, I would say, yes, there's this picture of running in SUSY, but don't get mistaken to think there's anything special about the scale where the mass spread goes negative. There's nothing special about that scale. It's some random scale that has to do with the ratios in initial conditions and the RGE equations and so on. Some totally random scale. You just have to keep running till the TEV scale and you stop the TEV scale. Okay? That's where the logarithms become small, blah, blah, blah. Now, what we've learned, the fact that the Z is at the bottom of the spectrum, what we've learned is that actually this scale is really close to the weak scale. That's crazy. It just looks nuts. It looks like they were running. Just as it crossed zero, you stop running. That's the weak scale. And in almost all the theories, when people say Suzy is tuned at the percent level, what they mean is if you take the Higgs mass parameter in like half an e-folding, it turns positive as you run to high energies. Okay. So why should that be? These are two scales that have nothing to do with each other. One scale is the overall size of the soft masses. It has to do with how Suzy is broken, transmitted, et cetera, et cetera. The other scale, the scale where this crosses zero, has to do with ratios of initial conditions, totally, totally different physics. And yet, it crosses zero and just stops right there. So this is the, this is called the, and cousins of this problem are known in other theories is known as the little hierarchy problem. And this is much, much more serious in my mind than any of the other things that people busied themselves with for 25 years, which is why you guys are in such goddamn good shape. Because none of these things are relevant. I mean, this is all like really tiny, at least in my mind, compared, this is a much more structural problem. It's what the theory is supposed to do. And okay, there seems to be something a little bit wrong. Now, so what could it be? So people have been trying a lot of different things. First, they're trying to just change the picture and say, no, for some special reason, it turns out the structure of the soft masses are such that that's not what's going on. Okay, that's one thing that you can do. So that's along the lines, there's a mechanism we haven't thought of yet that actually removes this problem. What I want to stress is that, and there are many papers on this, things like mirage mediation, combinations of anomaly, mirage mediation, other sets of ideas along these lines, the MMSSF, blah, blah, blah. What I want to stress is that you also don't need to know about the details of any of those things. Because if that's the solution, if there's some clever mechanism, we haven't thought of it yet, that evades this problem, we actually know what it looks like phenomenologically already. What it looks like is that all the superpartners are light, all of them are, you know, beneath 500 GeV. Somehow the spectrum got very squashed. Okay, we don't know how, but it's a squashed supersymmetric spectrum. And you know, when we hit 200 GeV, from 200 GeV up to 500 GeV, we'll discover 90 new particles. Okay. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that it is just a percent tune. Other accidents happen. Okay. Many accidents have happened in the history of particle physics. Like, in fact, accidents are more common than not. You know, Yukawa won the Nobel Prize for the wrong particle. He won the Nobel Prize for the pion, except it was the muon, and no one knew it. And then they discovered the pion. He must have been shitting bricks, right? But it turned out, actually, you know, they were both there. But why? Why are their masses 1/135, 1/131, just designed to confuse people for 10 years? Okay? And it just kept happening again and again. The charm and the tau were right on top of each other. Right? That confused people. That's a total accident. Maybe there's accidents. Maybe there's a percent level accident like this. That may be true, but I do want to remind you that I started with other examples where the idea of naturalness was right in the first lecture, and as you recall, they were all really right. No one, as I said, was sitting around talking about, well, maybe the Romazon is at 4 GeV and there's a 10% tuning in the mass for the pi plus. No. The Romazon came in before it needed to come in, at 770 MeV, not 1 GeV, just solved the problem. And no one said, oh, maybe there isn't the positron, Lorentz invariance is broken, the positron is up at, you know, 6 times the electron mass, and there's another contribution. Like, no, the positron came in 137 times earlier than it had to solve the linear divergence problem of the self-energy of the electron. Okay? So maybe there is a very smart mechanism, in which case we should really expect Maria's exhortations that everything is going to happen in the first 100 inverse picobond will really be true. Okay, if Suzy is natural, my God, we're going to be flooded with data from year one. Okay, or maybe it's just percentage tuned. That's life. The spectrum is, you know, happened to be at the bottom. It's a little bit of an accident. Then it's a bit of a, it's a more of a crapshoot. You see, if it's going to be tuned at 1%, why not at 10 to the minus 3? Okay, if it's 10 to the minus 3, then the scalars are at 3 TeV. That starts getting a little harder to see. But anyway, still, the LHC is still great. It'll go up. It'll probe scalars up to 2, 3 TeV. And that might just be what we find. But I do want to stress this. We might discover low energy supersymmetry. Celebration, everything is great. After the initial drunken period, people will then, now we measure these parameters, great, we'll do the running, and we'll find, holy shit, it's just turning positive right away, right? This would be a remarkable little puzzle. Why the hell is this most natural, beautiful theory that we could imagine doing this really weird thing? That might be actually telling us something. Or it could be there's something much more dramatic going on, but I'm not going to talk about the much more dramatic possibilities. So let me just then say, what is it you need to know about supersymmetry? After all of these lectures, you can forget about everything. And okay, so four things you need to know about SUSY. And I really want to stress this, because what you really need to learn about is collider physics. Okay? What you really need to know about is what plots people like Maria will be making. What are the axes? What do they mean? If you don't know what a PDF is, ask someone. Okay. And what are you supposed to take away from these plots? How are you supposed to decide? And if the experimentalists are telling you if they've discovered something, how do you know whether you should believe them or not? I tell you, most of the time, you shouldn't believe them. Okay. Because they've really screwed up royally many times in the past. Bert Richter famously went around telling theorists they were full of shit and had no idea what was going on because R was rising. You idiots, you think there's asymptotic freedom. And it shouldn't be doing that, but it's rising, you morons. And well, that was because he was seeing the charm. And he didn't know that. And the 60s were a period where experimentalists ruled. In a sense, the theorists had no idea what was going on, so experimentalists got used to making fun of them. And then, you know, the standard model, the people who knew what was going on knew what was going on, and there was a reversal where the theorists knew what was going on all the time. They said, yeah, I'll measure that. Ha-ha, I told you so. I told you so. All right? And it was like that for 30 years. Now we're in a situation where, like, well, maybe you should see supermarkets. So now we're both full of shit. So we have to learn to help each other a little bit. But I really want to stress this. Pay attention to Tao's lectures. Read everything you can about the LHC. Read everything you can about what the plots will look like. Read old papers. Read the discovery of the top quark. Read the paper on the discovery of the top quark. This is a beautiful thing, which when I was a grad student, I was like, yeah, big freaking deal, top quark, we know it's there, and so on. All right, still, it's an experimental tour de force. And if you want to see what a discovery is going to look like in a Hadron Collider, even for a particle we know everything about ahead of time, read that paper to see actually how hard it was. So I'm just saying this because these are really the important things in the next number of years. It's good to have it's good to have the theoretical background. It's good to, and that's why I gave the lectures, because SUSY, despite its warts, is still the most beautiful idea we have for what might happen at the TEV scale. So it's important to understand its guts. But like everything, you understand the guts once, and then you keep some set of things in your mind for what you actually use day to day. So this is what you need to know about SUSY day to day. Four things. Okay, thing one. Superpartner, standard model particle. That's all the vertices that you care about in a collider, look like that. Okay? So you make these things in pairs, therefore. You make these things in pairs, and the superpartner decays to another superpartner and a standard model particle. And this process can keep going. Okay? So familiarize yourself with what all of these can look like. For example, it can look like Galeno, Squark, Quark. Or the other way around, or a slepton, lepton, photino, okay? And so on. Okay, so familiarize yourself with what this looks like. Two, again, typically colored guys, probably heavier. At least we know they're probably relatively heavy. And this is important for two reasons. One, the colored guy is really what you should focus on at zeroth order for the LHC. The LHC is a gluon-gluon machine, dominantly, so we'll make lots of colored guys, even if they're quite heavy. let me just give you a calibration for this. I'm sure Tao will tell you in more detail. But just as a number to keep in mind, at the 10 to the 34 luminosity, mind you, so at the ultimate luminosity of the LHC, you know, the current experimental limit on gluinos from the Tevatron is, I don't know, 250 GeV. Let's say they were actually at 300 GeV. At high luminosity, you would be making a gluino pair every second at the LHC. Okay, so we go from not seeing them to making a pair a second. Okay, so that shows you that if you make colored things with a big cross section, even if the gluinos are up at 2 TeV, you know, we'll make hundreds, thousands of them in the first year. Okay? So you'll make lots and lots of colored particles. And that's important because then they will decay. But when they decay, like let's say I make a gluino, it'll decay to a squark and a quark. Now the squark has got to decay, and this will keep going, and that will keep going. Okay, so you have these trees that keep going down. And that's why supersymmetry looks complicated at the LHC, because you start with colored particles, and then there's a cascade decay down the chain with lots and lots of other things coming out. And ultimately, if R parity is good, some missing energy as well. Okay? So that's the other thing to keep in mind. What things are going to look like is you make colored things, and they're going to cascade decay in a complicated way down to things which will ultimately carry away some missing energy. The third generation can be special. For example, there are large couplings. The Topical coupling is a big coupling. There's a big coupling between the Higgsino and the Higgs. And anyway, there are lots of big couplings associated with the top. So one should think, pay special attention to tops and bottoms that might come out of the LHC. Okay, so there should be interesting new physics associated. Really, if the hierarchy problem is solved, no matter how it's solved, something totally model independent is we must see excesses in events involving tops and bottoms. Because there's got to be some friend of the top quark. Remember, that was the biggest problem of all, was the top quark. There's got to be some friend of the top quark. There must be excesses involving tops and bottoms. Whether or not we can dig them out is a totally different story. But they really must be there. So the third generation is special. Keep it in mind. And finally, this is just a repetition of Maria's point from yesterday. 100 at Imre's Pico Barn. So this is December 2008, at least on their capes. I encourage you to steal them. I didn't say that, Maria. Please don't tell me when I said that.
Yeah, well, I can.
All right. Yes. We'll send in commandos to steal them. Theory commandos to steal them. That could be plenty. It could really be plenty. Okay. It'll take a while to, as she said, I'm really repeating what she said, it could take a while to send the detector and so on. But, you know, you should not think of this as a, we can go to the beach for a few years and, you know, everyone will clean things up and we'll come back. No. All of the exciting things, not all of them, many exciting things, especially if Susie's natural, will happen very quickly. Okay. And it'll be very important to get the gross structure of what's going on worked out quickly. That'll be the biggest challenge of all. That's why I'm saying, if you can do something with your time, do not waste it on this very detailed model of flavor and blah, Susie breaking blah, blah. Doesn't matter. Right? What matters really a lot is seeing how we're going to get the basic gross structure of what's going on in the first 2 or 3 years. Then we'll have all the time in the world to, you know, to have fun with it later, okay? But this is a different kind of physics. It's not very well-worn territory. I mean, you know, the community of people have spent, there's a fantastic community of people who have spent time when other people have been doing other things, thinking about these things, but it's not a huge community, and there's not all the problems have been solved, not even close. And I think Powell will tell you that, and will also tell you about what some of the very good standard ideas have been so far. But there's really a lot of room for creative and interesting thought along these lines. And so finally, I just have to say that, you know, I have it better than my advisor. My advisor's generation would spend twice as long without data as I have. I entered the field of, when Maria put up her slide, it reminded me. I started grad school in 93, right after the SSC was canceled. Right as it was canceled. And, you know, I thought, and I thought, what should I do? And I heard there was this LHC. I said, okay, that's okay. People said back then, 2000, I added 5 years. And okay, it's not bad. But there have been people who have been waiting twice as long for it. This is not the sort of thing that happens every day. It's the sort of thing that happens every generation. So you're very, very lucky to be in the era where it's about to happen. Whatever comes up, you know, whatever is going on, this is what fundamental physics' job is now, is to responsibly, properly, correctly figure out what it is. But I have to say that the situation could not possibly be more delightful, because we're confused. We're really confused. We have completely contradictory hints from experiment. Totally contradictory hints from experiment. On the one hand, the precision measurement of the couplings that showed the Susie picture of gauge coupling unification is beautiful. Dark matter, all these other sort of nice structural things are working out great. On the other hand, we have the whole litany. Why don't we see any of those things? And down at the bottom, finally, this much more serious, to me, question of why the spectrum looks backwards from what you would have naively expected. Okay? These things just collide with each other. And I think it's going to have an answer. I don't know, but I think that's the question, really, a really good theoretical question to focus on. If you want to focus on a sort of model question, that's the most important model question to focus on. But that's also the question that we'll really start having an answer to very, very, very quickly. So things could not possibly be more delightfully confusing. And it's the best possible thing for you guys, because you can really, as I said, and I'll say again, you can ignore 90% of the literature. It was totally missing the boat of what the really important issue was. That's because of data. So the data, despite the fact that nothing has been discovered, that fact has had a profound influence on our thinking. Okay? And it's really changed the issues that people care about. That's it. Enjoy.